But any progress, we believe any progress across the entire sector, it, you know, is good for our industry. And what makes our aircraft special is that, you know, we've been at this for 10 years doing a lot of design, development, and testing. So we're deeply involved, and we're purposely developing. We've developed an aircraft that we believe has the right balance of range, speed, payload, and really important, that low noise footprint.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. Bonnie Simi not only heads operations and HR at Joby Aviation, she's one of the most inspiring women in aviation I have met and gotten to know better in the last 10 years or so. Her career has been nothing short of inspiring and stellar, from an ex-Olympian turned TV anchor turned United Airlines pilot turned JetBlue pilot turned JetBlue University chief to finally leading JetBlue Ventures and leading the investment into Joby and her vision around eVTOLs transforming everyday travel, not just air travel, is quite inspiring. I'm sure you will enjoy listening to this interview as much as I enjoyed my conversation with Bonnie. Bonnie, it's great to be speaking with you once again. I have been always impressed every single time we have spoken. You're onto something completely new in your career. The last time we spoke, you were heading up JetBlue Ventures, or JetBlue Technology Ventures, as it was then known. And now you're the CEO at Joby, one of the two or three hottest eVTOL startups in the world, if I am to say right now. What prompted the move from JetBlue Ventures, where I think you were doing a fantastic job, to Joby?
Yeah, so you know what? When we launched JetBlue Technology Ventures back in 2016, one of the fundamental areas, you know, we invested in various themes. And one area is we believe that electric propulsion would fundamentally change aviation, just like jet propulsion did back in the 60s. I mean, there hasn't been a whole lot of innovation in the aviation space, but we saw that changing. And so we wanted to invest in that space. And we scanned the entire world. We looked at, you know, thousands of startups in all different areas, but it was specifically within the space of electric aviation, about 50 different companies. And now, of course, there's hundreds, but back then it was about 50. And we ruled out all of them for a variety of reasons. We wanted to make sure it was piloted. We wanted to make sure it had the right management team. They had the right technology, et cetera. And we really settled on Joby back then. And it was, the company was only 50 people. And so we invested in 2017 a lot because of the leadership team, because of Joe Ben and his vision. And they've been at it for a really long time. So we invested very early on. And then when JetBlue Ventures invests in something, they really lean in and help. And so, of course, we did that. I joined the board. So I had literally had a front row seat. And then as time evolved, the company was growing so much and it was getting ready to go public. And at the same time, of course, was COVID for the airlines, which was a challenging time. So JetBlue Ventures could not do any investments during that time. And Joby needed a lot of help because they were going to be going public. So it was a very natural transition. And Amy Burr, who's now the president of JetBlue Ventures, was doing really well. So it was just a nice transition time. And then I really believed in the vision when we invested, and even more so after being with working with the team for so long. So, you know, you can talk about investing money, or you can talk about investing your heart and soul and your own personal time. I guess that shows how much I believed in this company and the vision.
Now, the interesting thing is JetBlue Ventures was one of the early ones to bet big on Joby. Has that vision, as you now are working within the Joby team, has that vision come to fruition? Do you feel
you're going down the right path? Or was there something you saw there that was, you know, different from what it is today? How has that journey been?
No, the journey, I mean, literally the journey that Joe, and the vision that Joe Ben set out when he was pitching to us back in 2016 and 17 and pitching to the world, not many people were listening at the time, but we did, and we believed him. We were able to bring on Toyota as well. So that was part of what JetBlue Ventures did, is brought in Toyota. Of course, Toyota has since invested a lot more than JetBlue over that time. And so the vision has stayed true, is, you know, to save a billion people an hour a day and to be a commercial operator. So we are very vertically integrated, designing, manufacturing, and operating the aircraft. And that was the vision back then, and it is still the vision now. We're building it out, and it is coming to reality. We are leading in this space worldwide. And I have to say, JetBlue Ventures did a very nice investment.
I'm glad to hear that. Now, Joby has been on a slow and steady journey compared to, let's say, one of your competitors, Archer, whose CEO I had on the show, who've been on a really fast and furious journey. And, you know, you are heading towards, you know, certification in 2025. Do you believe you're on track to meet that target? And is a slow and steady approach paying off?
I wouldn't say that, you know, we're slow and steady. In fact, our journey's been anything but slow. Yes, we started back in 2009. So I think that the initial period, perhaps from as we were fleshing out the various designs from 2009 through till 2017, that was a little bit slower. But once the really had settled upon the design, it has been a fast and furious time ever since. And, you know, it is a monumental task to design and certify an aircraft, and it is also a monumental task to develop an airline. So we are working on so many parallel streams. And so it's been in a very fast and furious and exciting journey, because we're also doing a lot of work with the Department of Defense. And so we're operating with them as well. We have some excellent contracts. We're getting some, we call payments from them, is through our flight testing phase. So we are on track. We are expecting to start our commercial air service in 2025. And we're working very closely with the FAA, which, of course, the FAA being the gold standard. Administrator Billy Nolen and his team are really leaning in for us. You know, we've completed already the first two of five stages of certification, and we'll have the third stage complete very soon. And we've got a very robust test program. We're out flying almost every single day. We have our company conforming aircraft will be coming off the production line the first half of this year. And we do believe we're well positioned to reach commercial service by 2025.
I'm really glad to see all the progress you have been making. And I know Billy is extremely excited. I've been seeing some of his posts as well. He's totally leaning in.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? I want to share a fun little anecdote about Administrator Nolen. You know, he came out to see our operation. He was very, very engaged. We operate at Marina Airport. We have locations all around. We have a location in San Carlos for our battery and powertrain. We have Santa Cruz, which is our headquarters and our software development and engineers, and then our manufacturing location in Marina. Now, Marina is a repurposed military base. It was the Fort Ord. It was called Fritchie Airfield, and it was an Army helicopter base. Guess who was based here? Flying helicopters, Billy Nolen. And so we're actually doing some of our manufacturing and work inside a hangar that he was operating in. So it was really fascinating as we walked by. He's like, I remember that. So, you know, because remember, he's an aviator, right? And so it was really neat to see that, the twinkle in his eye.
That is fantastic. I had no idea about this, this little...
We didn't either. And so, yeah, we walked by the hangar and he said, yeah, I stored my aircraft in there.
This makes it personal. How is the Joby eVTOL different from the one at Archer or Vertical Aerospace or even Volocopter over in Europe?
Sure. Look, you know, we're a kind of company that is very focused on what we're doing. And it's really not our place to be commenting on competitors' aircraft. But any progress, we believe any progress across the entire sector, is good for our industry. And what makes our aircraft special is that, we've been at this for 10 years doing a lot of design, development, and testing. So we're deeply involved, and we're purposely developing. We've developed an aircraft that we believe has the right balance of range, speed, payload, and really important, that low noise footprint. I think the number one thing that people think about on the customer side of it is safety. So we're building an extraordinarily redundant aircraft, far more redundant than any helicopters that are out there flying now. And more redundant than most aircraft as well. So the safety aspect is incredibly important, but right behind that is the noise. And we've had, NASA's come in and done a noise study to actually validate what we're saying about how quiet it is. And when people come see us, remember, we're operating at a public airport, so people can walk up and watch our aircraft, which flies every day. The thing that they're most, that catches them most by surprise is how quiet it is. I mean, it kind of sounds like just like an air conditioner that one would have at your house. It's very, very, very quiet. It blends in into the noise. So for us, what we believe is different perhaps is, we're 13 years in. We have thousands of flights. The aircraft has proven its range, noise, speed, and we've got a lot of momentum. And most of all, honestly, we have such an amazing team. We've got, we're approaching 1,500 team members around the world. We have locations in a variety of different countries. We're just very well positioned. So it's the employer of choice in this space as well. We get candidates from all of those other companies come to us. And that helps us really, because in the end of the day, what powers our aircraft are our people.
So this is interesting. I want to touch a little about this. How do you attract the right talent? I mean, eVTOL is such a nascent space. Do you go to the Airbuses and the Boeings of the world and say, hey, you know what? I want to attract the best engineers. Do you go to Tesla and SpaceX and say, you know what? Come with me because you have no aviation background. What do you value? Someone who has aviation background or no? Where have you had a success?
Yes. And yes. And yes. Right? Because we absolutely do bring in people from the Boeings and the Airbus and, Textron and you name it, Gulfstream, every aircraft manufacturer out there, OEM, we've got people from literally, I think, across the world, any major OEM. And because you need some of that experience, the aircraft certifications experience especially. But we also draw a lot from all of the electric EV type companies, Ground, Tesla, and yes, we've got people from SpaceX, we've got people from Rivian and Lucid Motors and Fisker, for those who remember. I mean, you name it, all across the board. But we also have from Toyota and from Ford and from GM, and so it's a very broad network. We also have, remember, we're also building out our own software code, right? So we also have people that are coming in on the software side. So you've got some Honeywell and some Collins, but then you've also got some people that are coming from, the Googles and other in Waymo and places like that too. So it's a really interesting mixing pot where the common factor across all of them is that it's just extraordinarily talented individuals. We could probably run a university here with the number of PhDs that we have. It's just, I'm constantly awed by the people. And the other common denominator is everyone here is very mission driven. So it's the kind of people who are here. Yes, it's nice to have a paycheck, but it's really because we're all here to bring this vision to life. And we have that common culture fit.
The interesting thing is, Bonnie, you're one of those rare people who have led a people team at an airline. And now you are the CEO here at Jovi at an eVTOL startup, mature startup, I would say. How is How is it different from leading HR or people function at the airline, at JetBlue for that matter?
Well, yeah. And so I lead operations, so sort of air operations and people. I also have facilities, safety, sustainability as well. So in that function as sort of head of air operations and people. So let's talk of the people side on the HR side. And I meant what I said. What really powers Joby, but really what powers any company is really the people. And so and what's unique here was similar, honestly, at working at JetBlue is to have someone in leading HR who understands the operation. So it helps keep the people function fully embedded in the rest of the company rather than siloed. In fact, you know, I literally just came off of my my team meeting with my direct reports, and you know, there is somebody overseeing each of these areas. I have somebody overseeing facilities, somebody overseeing people, somebody overseeing our commercial operations, our maintenance. They all report into me, and they're all on the same call. And so, when you think about, you know, the facilities function, for them to know what, you know, how many people are we hiring, because that matters on how many meals are served, how many rooms we need, how many buildings we need, you know, what is our simulator plan going to be? Well, that depends on facilities. And then also you have to hire new people to run simulators. So it all runs together. And so I think that it allows the people function to be more operationalized, but likewise, it allows the operations function to have that people mindset of, you know, setting goals and performance and how do you hire? I'm very involved in the hiring of my team because I oversee hiring for the whole company, but it also, I can help think across all these various functions because when somebody comes to a company, and I believe this at JetBlue and I believe it at Joby, you know, we want people who are going to be here for a full career. And so if you're hiring a young, you know, mechanical engineer straight out of school, what does their career arc look like? So we need to be thinking about those types of things. And so when I think of not only is what is this role that this person we're hiring for, but what is their next job? Because that keeps them engaged.
I remember, this is very insightful, by the way. I remember speaking with you maybe 7-8 years ago when you told me about JetBlue University and how excited, I think it was in Florida, if I'm not wrong, how excited flight attendants were at JetBlue University. And the one thing that stood out to me in that conversation was culture, culture, culture. JetBlue was all about culture, and that's why people came there as opposed to other airlines. And here, what I'm hearing is vision, vision, vision of how far we're going. Am I right to say that?
Yes. And so, I mean, I think that you know, it was very similar at JetBlue too, right? As it was to bring humanity back to air travel. That was the vision and that, you know, humanity element. And again, there's a human element to the vision that we have here at Joby. And I would say having, you know, I spent 18 years at JetBlue and I'm now, by the time you count in the board serves off 5 years here, is a very similar culture. It's people wake up wanting to come to work because of what we're building and being part of that magic, as opposed to, you know, how many hours and I'm punching a clock. And we do foster that. So we, you know, provide a lot for our team members and we're very much a family. And sometimes people do leave. And then we have what we call our boomerangs and they do come back because they realize the grass is not greener elsewhere. And again, I'm just going to keep saying, and I don't mean this to be a recruitment video, but I'm just so passionate about this company and what a magical place it is. And I just like to share that story for people.
I'm glad you're sharing it. And thank you for being open. Let's talk about Delta a little, because to fly eVTOLs, you somehow have to sell the tickets. Normal people have to access it. And you have struck a very tight partnership with Delta Airlines, which is also an investor in Joby. Tell me, how will you plug into the Delta network? Can I, for example, buy a ticket from London to LA and then take one of the Joby eVTOLs to Long Beach to catch one of the Olympic Games in a few years?
Yeah. So the way we're very passionate about this partnership, which is what we call delivering a sustainable home-to-seat service, a home-to-airport service, and that would be, you know, exclusive to Delta. And really, it's solving one of those most painful pieces of the journey, getting to and from the airport. So, you know, imagine being at home and opening an app on your phone and instantly booking a ride to the airport. And so what'll happen is a car will pick you up and whisk you very short distance to the local Joby vertiport. And then you fly above the traffic directly to the airport and then a short walk to your airline seat. And so this kind of makes this very, very seamless across. And, you know, we plan to very deeply integrate into Delta. And, you know, ideally will be our joint vision. And, it, you know, details haven't been finalized, but both Delta and Joby envision experience where customers can choose to book their seat in the Joby service at the same time they're booking their Delta ticket. So it becomes a very streamlined booking process. And that's our sort of, the whole focus is very, very customer centric. How can we make this seamless and enjoyable end to end?
I'm trying to, you know, visualize this, and it reminds me of an all-inclusive resort at a beach where I could drop my baggage at the resort and my bags would make it to the plane, and I just walked onto the plane at the end of the day, spending my entire day sipping, virgin pina coladas at the beach, for example. Is that the vision where, you know, I could just check in everything through Joby and I don't have to go line up at the gate and then line up again at security and then line up again at the check-in counter? Is that still going to be part of the process?
Yeah, I mean, our vision, I mean, that North Star, again, joint North Star, we're still working through all of those details, is that you will go from, yeah, you'll take your bags, you'll be with you. So that's the other thing. People get a little bit afraid about like letting their bags go, but your bags will be with you when you car right to the Joby aircraft, right to, you know, we're working. Our vision is, of course, when you think of security, of course you have to go through security. Will TSA be at the location of the vertiport, or will it be once you get to the airport, right? But it'll be a dedicated platform either way, so that you're not in through the long line or not separating. That's our North Star. I mean, bringing in right into the airside is where we plan this service over the arc. Initially, it may not be that way, but that's our North Star. So it's, again, seamless. And I think, you know, Shane, you've done, I'm sure, a lot of studies where you think of the happiness and sadness or the pain and of a customer journey. And where is it? I mean, the airlines have really focused on making that journey from the time you get to the airplane till the time you get off the airplane, really an amazing experience. Airlines really are stepping up to the plate there. But it is that journey to get to the seat and afterwards that is where the pain and the drama and the frustration are for customers. And so that's what this service is meant to alleviate.
Wow. I just felt the pain and the drama, as you were speaking through it. Will you be selling Joby tickets through the Delta website and Delta app, or will you be having your own distribution channels?
So we will, first of all, we have, of course, now our home to seat service is exclusive to Delta. However, not everybody who uses the Joby platform are going to the airport. They may be going from one side of town to the other, et cetera. So of course we will have our own app, and we're actually designing it now with our current 135 operation that we already have with conventional aircraft. Then we will also be selling through the Delta platform. Again, final details haven't been worked out. It's going to take a little while. As you know, integrating booking platforms is a little more challenging. But yes, the opportunity, the plan is that customers will be able to book through Delta, or we will be able to book through Joby. So you probably wouldn't be able to book Delta flights on Joby, but you would be able to book.
You never book know. Maybe take a revenue share on the Delta.
You never know, though. You never know. Like, never. Yes.
We've spoken about Delta, but originally JetBlue Ventures invested in Joby. I know there are some aspects of exclusivity for Delta. What remains then for other airlines like JetBlue to come partner with Joby? Do you think there'll be more partnership with other airlines, not just Delta?
So, I mean, we have our arrangement with Delta is an exclusive on that home to seat service. So they are our partner and our core and exclusive partner for that integrated service. Now, if our people are on other airlines, they absolutely can be booking through Joby as well. But in terms of that integrated, seamless service, that is exclusive with Delta. Now, we do have international, we have announced, for example, we have ANA as well in Japan. So there are some international opportunities that are underway as well.
Still sticking on international, it's perfect segue. I recently saw the Dubai Vertiport announcement. You mentioned ANA. There's, of course, the Delta partnership. Where all? You mentioned you want to fly 1 billion people. That's the vision. And help them save an hour, right? Flying over traffic. Where all can we see the Joby plane, let's say, before the end of the decade?
Well, we are, since we are the leading player in the space, you can imagine, we have pretty much everybody coming to knock on our door. What we've announced so far, we've announced this, the partnership, with ANA, we've announced it with Delta. We brought our virtual reality platform to Dubai, and obviously there's a lot of excitement there. There's excitement in several other countries as well. So I'm not here to make any specific announcements on any other countries, but we are most definitely a global company.
I'm glad to learn that and see that. What do you say to skeptics who say that eVTOLs are a sport for the rich 1%, and this is never going to be about mass transportation?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are equating it perhaps to helicopter service, which is quite fairly expensive. And the reason it's fairly expensive is because the cost to operate those aircraft is very high. And the operational cost of an eVTOL, by the virtue of the fact, in part, because it's electric and there's no combustion engine, is dramatically reduced. So the scale of the production that we have, that we're planning, and other operators as well. I mean, I think that a successful eVTOL ecosystem involves, several different operators, just like there are for airlines. That's what really makes a robust industry. When you start thinking about the scale of the operations that are planned, it helps bring the cost per seat mile down. So initially, it might be, at the range of a, Uber Black or something like that initially, right? And quite frankly, when we initially launch, there's going to be extremely high demand and not a lot of supply just yet. I mean, think about it. One Airbus is going to 320 offloads 160 passenger, 180 passengers, depends on the model. And, we've got our Joby aircraft that, take force. So initially the cost will be more at that higher level. Our plan and our path is to get it down to more as taking the same as an Uber. So if you think about right now, taking an Uber XL, for example, from Manhattan to JFK will take you an hour and a half in traffic. It'll take you 10 minutes in our aircraft. So when you think about that, and the cost in that Uber is going to be $150, we can easily get down to that price fairly quickly after launch. And then you start bringing it down more and more and more, so that you get it down to thinking of it like a regular UberX.
Right. I like the vision. Then if the price is lower, then it's accessible definitely to more people. To get there, though, you will have to scale up manufacturing quite a bit. You have to make a lot of these little birds flying around. How do you intend to do that? And will Toyota and their manufacturing expertise have a role to play in there?
Toyota's already had a massive positive impact on Joby. They've embedded 30 plus engineers in our operation here. So I am currently taking this call from Marina, our low volume prototype manufacturing facility. So this is where we'll be, rolling out dozens of aircraft, not hundreds. This is where we refine all of our processes. This is where we ensure everything's repeatable. Because remember, we have a type certificate and then a production certificate. So all of that will be done on that low volume. In parallel, we're in the process of a final stages of an RFP for our phase one manufacturing site. We've been all over the country. Lots and lots of states want us to come there. We haven't finalized it yet. We plan to be finalizing in the coming months. It's pretty exciting because we bring jobs, a lot of jobs. It's not just manufacturing, but maintenance and pilots, all of these jobs to these local communities. And so that's where we'll build out our phase one. So that's where we can get to scale to hundreds of aircraft. And then we'll go from there.
This is really interesting to note because a car manufacturer's expertise coming in to build airplanes, you know, it's like taking the entire Boeing moving factory line to the next level here.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if you think of a Boeing and you think of all the parts that are a Boeing aircraft, ours is much, much more simple. Now, it is more complex, of course, than a car, but the type of production where we will be operating when we're reaching hundreds of aircraft is more, it's on low scale out of. So think of like the Lexus line instead of the Camry, you know, Camry line or whatever, right? The Toyota Corolla line, it's the higher end. And so Toyota knows how to do sort of that lower volume operation. And we're leveraging them quite a bit. We're also leveraging automation. So, you know, we are very fortunate in that our processes are being certified here in, you know, in 2020 through, you know, 2025, all of our process. And so the manufacturing processes that were put in place when a 737 was certified or these things have evolved. And so the processes and the production certificate will be based upon our newer processes, which are much more efficient. And so that is a really exciting opportunity for us.
That does make sense. As you scale up manufacturing, since you're a piloted aircraft, and we're in the midst of a shortage of pilots, where are all these pilots going to come from? Are you going to train your own cohort? Are you going to take them from airlines? Is Delta going to be providing or cross-training some of the pilots? How do you intend to tackle the pilot situation?
Oh, yes. It was funny. When I first met JoeBen back in 2017, I told him, I said, you know, we've been hesitant to invest in this space because on one hand, there's those that are choosing to do it without a pilot. We think that will take a very long time to certify. So that business model may not be very viable. And then those that are piloted, there's a pilot shortage. So how are you thinking about doing that? And he told me on that very first day, he said, I'm going to hire you and you're going to solve it for me. I laughed. It did take a little while longer. It took about 3 years and then I got hired. But actually, we can help solve it. And really what I mean here is that the aircraft itself is very simple to fly. That doesn't mean, though, that you don't need to have well-trained pilots. In fact, the pilots that will be operating our aircraft have to have a commercial pilot's license, instrument rating. And we are building out our training programs right from the very beginning. So it has been public that we already have a 135 operation with a certified aircraft. We are also building out a training academy. So we have employees, our own employees that are doing pilot training now, just so that we can build out all of our pilot training and ab initio training program so that we training these pilots in glass operations because our aircraft has Garmin 3000 so that they're very, very comfortable by the time they reach 500 hours and then they'll roll right into our platform. And our goal then is to produce pilots for our operation. Our goal is not like it is for a lot of other flight schools, to make money off of pilots. See what I'm saying is the part of the reason that flight training and why there's a shortage is because of the cost of a pilot training. Well, because you have to have, there's a profit motive. There needs to be for the flight schools, right? Whether you're a university and you need to bring in more and charge money for tuition or you're a, you know, APB flight school or one of these flight schools, they're a business. For us, our business is to develop a pilot pipeline so we can reduce the cost, get it fully accredited, so with grants and loans, so we can create more access. And what I'm very passionate about is about access to the pilot profession and maintenance and manufacturing, all aerospace, but me personally, I think of the pilot side, to those who maybe did not have access before. And so part of that reason is financially, so you can think about bringing into different socioeconomic groups. That's one part of it. The other part of it, you know, when I first became an airline pilot, it was 3 decades ago. So it's quite some time ago when I first started, and there were 2% of airline pilots were female. So now, 35 years later, it's only 6%. So there's fundamentally, we're missing out on half the population. Why is that? Yes, there's the finance side of it, but also it is very difficult to raise to be a mother and to raise a family as an airline pilot because, you know, you're gone overnights, internationally, you're on reserve, whatever it may be. Well, the Joby aircraft, it doesn't fly all-nighters. You see, it can't go that far. And so all of our pilots will be home every night. And so when I think about building a very, very solid career for a young female who wants to, you know, raise a family and be home every night, it's a great path. And then they can move on to the airlines whenever they wish. So that is how part of it. And then the flip side of it is, you know, there are a lot of Delta pilots who are retiring who are interested in coming into the 135 world and will also be a great source of talent for us. So I'm actually quite quite positive and very optimistic about our approach on the pilot because we, again, controlling our destiny.
I find it very, very fascinating that you highlighted this challenge around female pilots going up from 2% to 6% in 35 years. That's very unfortunate and sad. Are you aiming at something like a gender parity when it comes to Joby pilot?
I would love to have a gender parity. In fact, I would love to have even more females. So it's very well suited, quite frankly. And also, it's in general, female pilots in mass, in total, female pilots on average are slightly lighter weight than male pilots on average, slightly shorter. So a better fit to the mission, perhaps. So yeah, that would be great. But in the end, as the person leading both HR and operations, and I'm a female and I'm a pilot, you can understand I have a lot of sympathy for this and I have a huge passion. And it also happens to fit our mission quite well. So I do overall see this to be a very female-friendly workplace.
That's really heartening to hear because I had the CEO of Fiji Airways on the show who talked about gender parity in his senior management team. And I believe the only country with more than 40% female pilots in the world currently is India, of all places. So, but that's airline pilots. But, you know, if you can achieve gender parity here from an eVTOL perspective, that will be fantastic. One of the other things is vertiports. eVTOLs require a new infrastructure. And also in terms of planning flight paths and air traffic control, you are in charge of operations. How are you even meeting this rather complex challenge?
Yeah, so, you know, we look at the infrastructure piece, both on the ground and in the air. The you know, U.S. infrastructure is actually already set up for aircraft like ours. So when we think about it, there's 5,000 public heliports and airports across the U.S., most of which are very underutilized, some of which have higher utilization. But nonetheless, our aircraft can land at either an airport, like a regular airplane, or can land at a heliport, like a helicopter. So that opens up right away, for example, in New York, you know, there's three heliports in Manhattan. There's three major airports, Newark, LaGuardia, JFK. Delta's a big presence in that. Same thing in LA. There's quite a few airports in the area. So we can plug right in and likewise into the ATC infrastructure. So especially when you're operating initial launch into markets where we're, you know, dozens and up to 100 aircraft, as things get higher and higher volumes, yes, there'll be more work that needs to be done with respect to the airspace. And then, you know, infrastructure so through partners. So we think about first existing infrastructure and then infrastructure through partners. Think of it as, you know, parking decks. There are fewer and fewer cars going to the airport and parking at the airports or at the airport because people take, you know, ride shares and such. Same thing for shopping malls. There's fewer and fewer, you know, when you go to a shopping mall, less people going to the mall, they're ordering online. So you have this existing infrastructure that can be repurposed. And then thirdly, yes, some strategic investment through partners or otherwise or ourselves to build out some proprietary skyports and infrastructure. I mean, you mentioned the work that's going on in Dubai, for example. Those might be some greenfield work that's going on. So, you know, when we think about it, the entry into service we're not too worried about it. And then as that flywheel gets going, where more and more people want the service and more and revenue starts coming in, that allows then for more infrastructure to be either repurposed, like these parking decks, or strategic investment.
Yeah, this is very interesting. I remember Seattle Airport's CIO or head of facilities during COVID talking about, oh, let's repurpose our parking spots for eVTOLs. It seems like that day is not too far away.
Yeah, it's not. It's not because, you know, it's valuable real estate at airports. I mean, we are actively engaging with major airports in the U.S. as we speak, visiting several sites to look at parking garages. I mean, we're talking right now because, you know, we do need to plan some of these. You need to put in the electric infrastructure, so the electric power for powering them. But it's not unlike Tesla going in and putting those Tesla chargers, you know, in the backside of a shopping mall market. They just put in the chargers, and guess what? All of a sudden, the shopping mall's got more business because the Teslas were charging there. And our charging infrastructure is very similar to that of what a Tesla charger would be.
That's very interesting. Let me ask you this openly. Can you use a Tesla supercharger to charge a Joby eVTOL?
No, not. It's, like I said, it's a similar size. But no, it would be a different type of charging infrastructure.
Will you need more power or less power than a supercharger?
We haven't really disclosed kind of where we are in that. I will just say that when people are thinking about, okay, what does it take to charge an eVTOL? You can think about, you know, what is it at that mall that I went to and you saw the infrastructure, the systems that are there. So it would be very similar.
It's very, very interesting. I was speaking, I think, recently with the CEO of Harbor Air, and he talked about their Magni X electric motor. And they said, for every 10 minutes of charge, I get 20 minutes of flying. And that was very interesting because they fly 90-minute routes. So, you know, in their turnaround time, they can actually charge the entire plane for the flights, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's our, you know, we will be doing charging in between flights as well.
You just landed a contract recently with the U.S. Air Force as well. What is that about?
Yeah, so we do, we've been talking about this for quite some time, that we are our mission is on the civilian side to as a commercial operator. However, to the extent that our work can be dual use, when we think about, you know, a 737, for example, Boeing is a 737, right? There's the military version of the exact same aircraft, right? So you're just repurposing it, still carries passengers, still a transport category aircraft. It's the same thing for us. So we are operating, we're building out. In fact, as we speak, we have we're training some Air Force pilots to be flying our aircraft. So that's part of it. Like they're going through it's still flying remotely, but they're learning how to fly the aircraft. We will be then deploying on U.S. bases, doing more testing. You know, that's where we can first operate a passenger-like service, if you will. We'll start with boxes and stuff. And eventually, once we have the Air Force approval, we can fly passengers. And so we can do that. And it also helps then with our certification on the FAA side, right? Because they can see us operating. And so it's a very, very much the definition of dual use. And we're getting paid for it. So that's even better.
That's fantastic. That's how SpaceX, with their partnership with NASA, succeeded early in the days as well. So I'm glad to hear that. Now, you mentioned the grand vision of, you know, a billion people, helping them save that 1 hour to the airport. How do you think you will reach this vision and realize this vision? Do you foresee yourself going into ESTOLs, for example, a short takeoff and landing, a bigger version of the initial jet?
So there, I mean, Joby, right now, we are very, very focused on bringing this aircraft to service. One can imagine other iterations, and so more to come on that. It is public. We, of course, had acquired a company called H2Fly in the hydrogen side of things. So, but right now our focus is on the existing aircraft that we've talked about. But like I said, we've got enough PhDs here to start a whole university. So there's some real smarts and some really exciting stuff going on.
Hey, you've done JetBlue University, which was kind of different. Here you can do Joby University, which is a real...
Yes, exactly.
as interesting, Bonnie, as it is to learn about Joby, I think you yourself have a very fascinating story and career journey. And if I may share for my listeners, once again, you were an Olympian first, then you became a sports commentator on NBC, if I recall. Then you flew as a pilot for United for, I think, 13 or 14 years. Then you were at JetBlue for 17 years. Then you went to JetBlue Ventures, and now you're at Joby. How does one build a career like this? What's the secret here?
Well, you know, when I was a young kid, I wrote a list of things I wanted to accomplish in life. And of course, this was actually part of a school assignment. We had a world explorer named John Goddard who came to one of those school assemblies, and he'd had a list of like 127 things that he wanted to accomplish when he was a kid, and he'd accomplished almost 100 of them. And so we had this assignment to write a list. And so I said I wanted to go to a good college. I wanted to become an Olympian because it was an Olympic year when I did this. I wanted to work for ABC TV. I wanted to become a pilot. And I didn't think of being an airline pilot because back then there weren't any female airline pilots. I suppose if I knew that there weren't airline pilots, female airline pilots, I'd say I'd want to be the first one. But I just thought of flying a small plane. And then to build a log cabin. Now, I have done all those things. I have not built a log cabin. I have to have something for retirement. So part of the seeds of this, I guess I would say, is it started, you know, as a young kid. So I did go to college, initially majored in engineering, but pivoted into broadcast journalism because I was doing sports. And I'm like, hey, you know, what can an athlete do when they retire? When they retire, they can work in television. And so I did work for ABC TV initially. I was our local, so I was a writer, reporter, producer for the San Francisco station. And I did then commentary for Olympics, NBC as well. But while I was at the TV station, I saw the weatherman. And of course, pilots and weather, they kind of go there. And he happened to be a pilot. And so I started talking to him about it. And he says, yeah, you can just go to the local airport. So I went down to the local airport where I was living, was near Palo Alto, and he said, take three lessons. And that's what I tell everybody. If you ever say, I wish I could learn to fly, go take three lessons at a local airport. You don't need to know much. Just walk in, take three lessons. After three lessons, you'll have a good idea. And I was hooked. So I very quickly got my private, my instrument. And then I started working towards a commercial and an instructor rating. And that's when I realized that I really wanted to follow my heart into aviation. So that's where that came. And indeed, after doing some work in the corporate side, I ended up as a corporate pilot, I ended up going to United. And then eventually I really wanted to keep flying, but I wanted to be part of a new company. And JetBlue was new. And very innovative, and I could fly and do other things too. So I left United to go to JetBlue as a pilot and eventually moved into leadership there. And then came the opportunity to take JetBlue to the next level with JetBlue Ventures. And I was asked to take that back. So I came full circle back to the Bay Area. So that's kind of, it's just, you know, one thing led to another and just always being open for opportunities and working hard.
Saying yes, I think you say a lot of yeses. So I think that definitely has helped. How did you tackle that situation where you were flying for United? I think you went on the 777, if I'm not wrong, perhaps doing overnights and be on standby. How did you raise a family while doing that? The same challenge you mentioned earlier.
Ooh, that was, yes. So I have my daughter. She's now 24. So it's been a while, but I was a United pilot. It was very challenging. I did switch off of the international back to domestic before she was born. So I was a 727 captain at the time. And I was very junior. So I was on reserve. And it was difficult. Now, I had a wonderful spouse. He was a firefighter paramedic. So he had schedules too that were odd, although his schedules were all fixed. So we would organize the childcare to make sure that if I got called out on a trip, I mean, we had to have something for our little girl to go. So we had a wonderful family, my sister-in-law and my husband. It was, so she was raised by a village. And you know, if I'd had five kids, that would have been really hard. I had one. But I've lived through this. It's a challenge. And I'll say for all the mothers out there, who've been through this, I chose that I wanted her to be, naturally fed through her first 6 months. And you can imagine how difficult that is too. Like I didn't use sick leave. I came back off of maternity when she was 3 months, I want to say 2 months old. So just working through that was a challenge, but we did it.
Congratulations. This is so inspiring. The final bit of this interview is called the rapid fire round, in which we get to know you a bit more personally, and simple questions like, what's your favorite book, Bonnie?
Oh, my favorite book. To be honest, I don't have a ton of time because I'm always out there like creating things and making things. So I'm not going to give you a favorite book because it would be a different one, when I can pick something up here or there.
All right, fair enough. What about your favorite airline?
My favorite airline. Now you're going to put me on the spot. I spent the most of my career at JetBlue, so I'll say that. One can be very loyal because they spent a good part of their career there.
I will make sure that nobody at Delta or United hears this one. Maybe I should have asked your favorite non-US airline. That would have been
useful. Oh, yeah. So my favorite non-US airline. I spent a lot of, and part of this is just emotional. I spent a lot of my youth in sports, as you know, in the sport of luge, which is very much an international. We traveled a lot in Europe and particularly Germany. And so I have a very strong emotional connection to Lufthansa because Lufthansa yes, there's other companies that have different type of better service, but I'm at my core and I'm part German too. So I'm loyal to Lufthansa.
There you go. I'm sure I'm going to send this part to Lufthansa so that they can invite you for the new first class launch. What about your favorite city?
Ooh, my favorite city. I'll go back to the international side of things. And this will be again very unique, but when I think about just special moments, I think about the Chris Kindle Market in Innsbruck. I love Innsbruck and I love Munich. So again, getting back to my sort of roots a child, I have so many fond memories, Oktoberfest, if you will, in Munich and Chris Kindle Market in Innsbruck. So those would be my favorite cities.
Wow.
Unusual. People would not normally pick those cities, but
Innsbruck stands out because it has one of the most beautiful approaches to land at the
airport. It is a very interesting airport to come in through that valley. Exactly. It's a fascinating, fascinating ride for anyone who's ever flown into Innsbruck. Yes.
That's right. Innsbruck is gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. Yes. What's your favorite movie?
My favorite movie. I was inspired as a young kid by Top Gun. And honestly, if I went to the airlines as a pilot, I didn't have 20/20 uncorrected vision. Back then you had to have that. You didn't have to have that on the airlines, but you did in the military. I don't know if you still do. But I was very inspired by that movie too. I know a lot of young guys went into fighters because of that, but you know what? This young female went into the airlines in part because of that.
Did you like the new one better?
That one was a fascinating one. In fact, a little bit of inside, my neighbor runs the Patriot Jets, which is a civilian jet air show act, and they were actually the pilots for some of the stunts there. And so he worked very, very closely with Tom Cruise, and so we knew. I was very well connected to that movie because of some of the work that my neighbor was doing.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing to know. What is something you still want to learn, Bonnie?
What do I want to learn? I have a, and this isn't really, it's learn, but it's more of an experience. And I've lived a little bit of it vicariously apart through my husband, but One of the retirement projects I have is to hike the Pacific Crest Trail, start to finish. It's 2,600 miles, and it's a journey to learn. I'm a Californian. I grew up here in Southern California. I've lived in California for almost all my life. And really to learn, the best way to learn a place is to literally walk through it. So we started as a journey. My husband hiked a few of the segments, spent about a month last year. And it is something that I look forward to.
Wow. It's fascinating you mentioned hiking or walking, because I came across two stories recently. One of a friend who walked in Spain. There's this walking to the end of the world, to the westernmost part of Spain. And another one, which was, I think, the author Pico Iyer, who walked through Japan.
Oh, wow. It's just a way to reconnect. You know, I live a very type A life. I'm all over. I work very, very hard. And every year, and I've been doing it for almost 20 years, I take a week off and I go camping and hiking in the Sierra Nevada, which is up in the mountains in California. And it is some of the places where I'm the happiest. And so for me, that's a nice, and for those who are the global listeners who don't know about this, is basically hiking from the Mexican-California border all the way up to the Washington-Canada border. Yep. And so it's quite a journey, and often people do it in segments over many years. But it is something, you know, it's milestones, and I'm an achiever. I want milestones, and I want, you know, goals. And this is something that, you know, every step you're moving closer towards your goal. So that's something that excites me.
This is a fantastic way to close it. Then what is the best advice you have received, Bonnie?
Yeah, so the best advice I've received, honestly, is from my mother. She's my hero. She's no longer with us, but I remember when I came home from school with these crazy goals, and we grew up in a very small mountain town with very low economic means. She was a disabled school teacher raising three kids. And I said, I want to be an Olympian and I want to be a pilot and all of these things. And instead of her saying, no, you can't do that, we don't have the money, she said, sounds exciting. What's your first step? And so for me, I tell people is that, you know, you have to have a dream for a dream to come true. And once you have that dream, imagine, you know, your path, take a step towards it. And then you take another step and another step. And before you know it, you're there. So many people choose not to dream, or they think that, oh, I won't be successful. Imagine what would your goals or dreams be if you were 100% guaranteed to be successful. Then go ahead and start that journey.
Well, just get started. This has been such an inspiring conversation, Bonnie, from how you invested in Joby to realizing the vision to hiring pilots and potentially a gender parity when it comes to pilots at Joby to your own extremely inspiring journey. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd still like to share?
No, you've had a very wide ranging, and thank you for all the research. I think we've been following each other now for quite some time, and congratulations on all your business successes as well.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our Supervising Editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India, and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.